Tonight's attendance, 297. I will now introduce our speaker for tonight, Tina A. from Hollister, California.
My name's Tina Albert, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm really grateful to be here and be sober tonight, and that's really loud. Is that really loud? That's really loud. I'm really grateful to be here and be sober tonight, and if you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous, I'd like to welcome you. And before I get too self-obsessed, I'd really like to thank Jim for asking me to come and speak in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. It is always an honor and always a privilege. And when I was new here and I would get up to a podium similar to this one, but with a much smaller group, I would start speaking, and my sponsor would majestically arise from his seat in the front row about 2 minutes in and go, "You're finished now." And, you know, like 50-ish, and I would tuck my tail between my legs and crawl back to my seat. And he told me I wasn't allowed to speak in meetings until I had 5 years, like be a speaker. I couldn't do workshops until I had 10 years. I wasn't allowed to sit on any board of directors for the Alano Club that I got sober at, and I couldn't do any of those things. And I would say bizarre stuff like, "My name's Tina and I am an alcoholic," and he would go, "That's all you know? Sit down." And so I was raised in that kind of school in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I love it. I'm extremely grateful for that. I love the fact that I got sober when I did and where I did and who was there. And it was heaven sent and absolutely perfect for me at the time. But if you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, I want to tell you that there was this speaker that got up every year for the first probably 10 years that I was sober. And every single meeting he'd say, I'd like to welcome our new friends to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. Let you know that you never have to pick up another drink for the rest of your life, 24 hours at a time. And he would say it very majestically. His name was Tom Woods. And I love that man. And out of that statement, I got a lot of stuff. I got, even though it was a lot different from the people that I came in and got sober around, he called me his friend. And it had been a long time since anybody had done that. Most of the time I would come in and he would want me to leave. And he meant it. And then he told me that this was a fellowship that we had in here. It's a group of people joined together for one common interest. And I kind of like that. Nobody was above anybody or below anybody. We were just all fellows and the same. And then he said something that blew me away, and that was that I never had to pick up another drink for the rest of my life, 24 hours at a time. And for the first time in forever, not that first time he said it, but probably the 650th, what I heard was that I drank because I had to drink, and it clicked. Something clicked, and I love that. And he died sober with a bunch of years, and I loved him. And if there's one thing about Alcoholics Anonymous that is my absolute favorite, it is the people that I get to walk with on this journey. And I've walked with the masters. I've walked with some of the greatest people that I've ever met in my life. And if you're new here and you stay and you reach out your hand, I promise you, I swear that that could be true for you too. They also told me other nifty stuff when I was new, like the newcomer's the most important person in the room. And I was astounded at how quickly they figured that out about me. And then I stuck around long enough to realize that, like, without newcomers, could you imagine how inbred we would all be if we didn't have fresh blood coming in on a daily basis? I mean, we love you, newcomers. We really, really do. Anyway, so thank you very much, is what I was saying, Jim, for asking me to come and speak in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I can tell you that it's different than it was when I was new. And sometimes I love speaking because I get to listen to my favorite person talk about my favorite thing, and that's me. Because it's all about me. I've been sober for a long time, and it is still absolutely and completely all about me. Unless I let God interject every couple minutes in there, it is completely all about me. And my brain's wired that way, and I've been sober a long time, and I work the steps, and I do everything you guys tell me to do, and it still clicks there, and it's all right. I hide it really well until I tell you, and then I'm not hiding it anymore. But I spoke, the reason that I get nervous when I speak in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, I had a couple years, and one of my favorite old guys, his name was Noel Estes, and he's dead, so I can give you his last name too. One thing that happens when you get sober young and you stay sober for a long period of time is all those old-timers die, and then you're it. So, kicking and screaming, I swear to God, I'm it. Every step of the way. But this guy, Noel Estes, asked me to come speak. And he was one of my favorite guys. I saw him every morning at the 6:45 attitude adjustment meeting that I went to. And I was young when I got here. I was kind of like Tigger, and I would bounce in, making lots of noise, and I'd pounce on his lap. And he'd smile at me and just let me sit, you know. And his wife would smile at me and just let me sit. It didn't matter. And he asked me to come and speak at a Sunday morning 11-step meeting. And in a minute, I'm going to tell you how huge my aversion was to the idea of a power greater than me when I was new in here. And at that time, it still was. My first sponsor was an atheist/agnostic, and we didn't talk too much about God because I didn't want to hear it. And he didn't want to talk about it either, so it worked well. But I was going to go speak at this 11-step meeting, never having any experience, of course, the 11th step. But I thought because I'd been sober for a little while, I was going to be able to snow you guys really, really good, because I'm good at that. I like baffle you with bullshit, you know. And I'm a legend in my own mind. So I went to this 11-step meeting, and there were, I don't know, 30 or 40 people in there, and I started talking, and for some reason or another, I didn't do the whole what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like today. I just started talking about something I knew nothing about. And about 15 minutes into a 45-minute pitch, I started going, and everybody knew, you know. We know. That's one great thing about us in Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're new in here, I'm going to give you a secret. If you come in here and you talk about the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and you've never worked them and you hang out and talk long enough, we can smell you. We smell you coming, we know. And I thought for a long, long time that I could get up and do that, and you guys didn't know. And they knew, those guys, they just knew. And they'd write things on our cards. My friend Tom wrote on Chris's card, "Now you have a year sober, it's time to start working the steps." And like he was, I wasn't, but he was. I was just doing them a little out of order because there were some of them that I had an aversion to. Like 1 through 11 and a half. I'm just kidding, kind of. Anyway, I guess we better get off of this and get into the what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like today. You know, it says in our book that we share in a general way what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like today. So I'm going to do that for a minute. And I'm going to try really hard not to get a lot into a drunk a lot, because I think we all know how to do that just fine, or there wouldn't be 297 people in here. And I have to tell you, because I'm a little bit competitive, when Sam got up here and said 200, and well, I'm going to tell on you. He said 296, and I'm competitive in nature. One of my favorite speakers spoke here last week, John Ackerland, and there were 296 people in the room. And he came up to me and he said, "There's 296 people in the room." And I said, "Shit." Because I really wanted to beat John. And also, I'd like to invite you guys, because we're low on our prudent reserve, and I just found out that we have to move. When you don't put a couple bucks in the basket, you get stuck with local talent. Because they have to fly me here. So, so if you like what I have to say, you can come up and thank me after the meeting in front of the podium. And I think we'll start a new tradition this evening. Over here to the right of the podium, we'll start a line with Jim. And if you don't like what I have to say, he'll be there with a basket, and you can put a couple extra bucks in and take care of it. But really the reason I tell you that is because if I bore you, if you yawn, if you get up and go to the bathroom and I take it personal and I absolutely suck, it's Jim's fault. So, having said that, what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like today, I can tell you that before I ever picked up a drink of alcohol, I needed a drink. And my earliest recollection, and I don't remember a lot, but I remember being in kindergarten, so it put me about 5 years old. I was a really happy kid, and everything was good. My mom loved me. I had a great home life, and I went to kindergarten, and on Friday we did show and tell. And this little boy had this really nifty toy, and I wanted it. So I took it. And being sensitive and concerned about other people's welfare, I left mine in its place so we wouldn't have to worry about going home with no toy. Because, you know, I'm always about other people, too. So I took this toy, and I took it home, and I played with it all night, and I knew the next day I was going to be in a lot of trouble. So I took off from my babysitter's house with the toy, or it was Monday because it had been the weekend. I took off, and I went up the block the way I was supposed to go to school and around the corner, and I hung out in the park all day. And one of my neighbors caught me, and I got home that afternoon. My mom knew that I was 5 years old in kindergarten, and I had ditched school. So she was kind of wondering why, and so I told her, and she made me go into the principal's office with a toy and tell him what I had done. So we got a ninth step, right, making that direct amends. At 5, it sucked. At 41, it still sucks. really doesn't, but just difficult sometimes. So I took that toy into the principal's office, and I was in a lot of trouble, and I was mortified and humiliated, and I couldn't believe what I had done, and I needed a drink, and I didn't know it. And we moved from that area over into Manhattan Beach. It's this little upper-class beach community in Southern California. And I remember being in third and fourth and fifth grade and not feeling like anybody liked me. You guys know that feeling of just being a little bit different, a little bit separate, not good enough, not smart enough, new kid in class, whatever. And so I would go into my mom and dad's closet, and a nickel and a dime and a quarter at a time, I would steal their antique coin collection. And I would take it to school and buy 15-cent ice creams for all those kids that I knew that didn't like me. And the lady at the cafeteria window would look at the buffalo nickels and the Indian dimes, and she'd look at me, and she'd take the money and give me an ice cream. And I'd give it to somebody, because I would do anything to make you like me or to get a little bit of attention. And I didn't realize at the time what I really needed was a drink. And in fourth grade, I went back into that same closet, and I took my, this is horrible stuff, I took my dad's great-grandmother's mine-carat diamond ring that was her wedding ring, and I gave it to my teacher. Because she was this little hunchback woman, and she picked on me all the time in school, and she just hated me. And you guys all had one of those teachers, you know, just didn't like you. Come on, I know you did. And so I took this ring, and I gave it to her, and she took it, and she never said anything. And don't get shocked, because my mom got the ring back. But, you know, it's just like, it's funny today because I look back at the nature of people. And I was like 8 or 9 years old. That woman had no business taking a ring like that from me. And she told my mom that she thought it was a rhinestone when she got busted, and she gave it back. And it was really funny. Wench. So anyways, I didn't realize at the time what I really needed was a drink. And that's kind of thematic of my life all the way until I got into middle school, and I decided one day that I was going to cut school with my friend Carrie, and we were going to drink, and we were going to see what this alcohol was about. And so we ditched school, and we went over to her house, and we locked ourselves in with her little 9-year-old brother, because if I was in trouble, we were all in trouble. And Sean stayed home with us, and we started drinking out of this scotch bottle. And I hated the taste of it. I didn't like the taste at all. I put my tongue over the mouth of the bottle not to let any of that vile liquid get in my mouth. And I would move my throat and pretend like I was drinking because I'm good at fooling you guys, you know. And after a couple minutes, I watched my friend Carrie, and she started giggling and laughing, and she was having a good time. She wasn't chicken about ditching school anymore. And I intuitively knew that I wanted what she had. So I uncovered the mouth of the bottle, and I guzzled the scotch. And now she had drank some, so I had to drink quickly so that I could catch up to where she was. And I remember that first drink, it felt like every nerve ending in my body was on fire, and the top of my head blew off, and I hated it. Like my fingers were on fire, I burnt all the way to my toes, and it was just horrible. And about 20 seconds later, the most amazing thing that ever happened to me in my entire life happened. And what happened was I got this. You guys know the one? I see a couple heads going, yeah. You know, I promise you, if you're new in here, I get that sometimes when I come into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's that same, like I'm so safe and home here. But I got that feeling, and I didn't care about school, and you know, I was raised in Manhattan Beach, so all these girls that I went to school with that hated me, they all looked like Pamela Anderson before Baywatch. You know, they had long blonde hair, and they were tan and hung out at the beach, and they were just beautiful blue-eyed little petite things. And I was a foot taller than everybody in my class, and I had long stringy red hair, buck teeth, and freckles. And I would look at them and go, Pamela Anderson. Then I would look in the mirror and go, Pippi Longstocking. And I didn't feel, who said howdy doody? Somebody said that at dinner tonight, you know? They said they had a speaker up here a little while ago. He had red hair, and somebody goes, howdy doody. Well, I was Pippi Longstocking, so we're going to have to meet this me in the sky. Don't worry, honey. But anyway, I just felt like horrible, and that drink made it all go away. Nothing mattered anymore, you know? So we drank some more off of that scotch bottle, and my mom caught us ditching school. She came banging on the door, and before that happened, I got really sick all over the living room, and probably my friend Carrie, too. I don't know, because she didn't talk to me for a little while, but I just got really sick, and that was kind of thematic of the way that I drank. I threw up a lot, and normally I just guzzle real quick, puke, get it over with, and then I could drink, and I kind of liked it. I thought it was funny because it shocked a lot of people, and so we jumped out the back window of the house, and we were running all over the place. We were hiding by the water tower, and we were running from the cops and sneaking through backyards, and you know, about 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon, I was busted. I knew I couldn't go home. I was in so much trouble. And I immediately knew that the only logical solution to my problem was to take her 9-year-old brother and run away from home. So I did. You know, we stole a bike and off we went. And about 11 o'clock that night, I had a whiny, cold 9-year-old, and I was hungry, and we were in East L.A., and kind of scary there when you're 12 or 13 with a bike and a chain and a 9-year-old. So we ditched the bike and called the cops, and I went home, and that was that, you know. And I remember being so sick, and I was in so much trouble. And the next morning I woke up, I had a headache. I just didn't feel good, and I couldn't wait to do it again. And that's the way that I drank from the time I picked up a drink until I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. I drank myself into and out of high school. I drank myself into and out of every job that I ever applied for or got. I drank myself into an amazing job. It was right down my career path, more money than I had ever made in my life. And I was 17 years old, and I was working a drive-thru window at Burger King. And I turned around one day, and there was a Marine Corps recruiter standing there. And through a lot of funky circumstances and odd situations, he ended up with my phone number, and a couple months later, I was in Navy boot camp on the 21st of December in 1981. And because it was 4 days before Christmas, I was like the only one there. You know, there were a couple other people, but we sat there in the processing barracks, and I was so sick. Because I had been drinking and doing lots and lots of alcohol-enhancing chemicals for a long, long time. And you know, I heard somebody say the other day, I drank alcohol, I smoked alcohol, I snorted alcohol, I fried on alcohol, I injected alcohol. I loved alcohol. And I loved a lot of other things, too, and that's as far as I'm going to get into that. But I ended up in boot camp, and I was 17 years old, and I was sick. And, I got off the bus. It was 11 o'clock. They're screaming at me and grabbing my suitcase. And, I mean, it was just dramatic and stupid, and I thought, in the morning, I'm going to be able to talk to somebody in charge and be able to explain the situation, that there's been a tragic mistake that's been made here, and they're going to let me go home. And it didn't happen. So I stayed in boot camp. I got in a lot of trouble in boot camp. I was the youngest person in my company. I got you all in trouble in boot camp, because that's how boot camp goes if you've never been. They pick one person that's the biggest screw-up, and everybody pays for him, and that was me. So I had a lot of friends. But I met the commanding officer in my boot camp because I drank during my work week, and I got busted for drinking in boot camp. They were going to kick me out. And I was 17, and I was afraid, and I was remorseful. And, you know, the opportunity just presented itself, and I took it. Who wouldn't, right? And so I got in trouble, and I got through that. I graduated with my company, and I went to school, and I got in trouble at school. I drank on duty and left base, met the captain, blah, blah, blah. And that was kind of thematic, too, of all of my duty stations. I like to meet the captain. And I know there's easier ways to meet the captain, but I'm a little dramatic, and, you know, I did it the wrong way. So anyways, by the time I graduated school, they sent me to my permanent duty station, my first one. I was a cryptologic technician. I was in naval intelligence, and I had lots of high security clearances. And we were, you know, it was 1981. It was Cold War era, and so they sent me to Adak, Alaska, which is this little Aleutian island off the Kamchatka Strait in Russia. It's this little ice-covered rock in the middle of nowhere because I pissed off somebody. So that's where they sent me. And I can tell you that I was on that island, I don't even know. I had one of those little short-timer calendars that was supposed to be there for a year, and it started at 256 days, because we had to count one day at a time, one day at a time, one day at a time, long before I ever came into Alcoholics Anonymous, trying to get off that rock, you know. And I drank a lot. I was always looking for the party, and my friends were always leaving me, and I would take off walking at night, looking. They had these old Quonset huts on the island from World War II, and we'd go out and we'd take one of the Quonset huts and we'd turn it into a big party hut, and every Friday and Saturday we'd be there because it was ours until we left. And I would walk around looking for the Quonset huts, and nobody would tell me which one we were at anymore because they didn't want me to come. And one night I figured, you know, I have a keen alcoholic intellect, and I saw lights coming, and I thought the only logical thing for me to do would be to lay down in the middle of the road. They would see me laying there, they would stop, and I would get in the car. And it worked. Somebody stopped, I got in the car, we invariably showed up at the party, and so it worked so well, I did it a couple more times, and by the time I left the island, they would see a lump laying there, and they would drive around it and just leave me laying in the middle of the ice. Anyway, I did get sent off the island for a short period before I got sent off for a long period, and I was sent to Elmendorf Air Force Base in Anchorage, and I spent a little bit of time on the psychiatric unit on the seventh floor of the hospital because I was kind of crazy. And not that I was crazy. I really didn't think I did, but I did really bizarre things when I was under the influence of alcohol, like lay down in the middle of the road and expect the car to stop. They had long since put me on anabuse, and I drank on that numerous times and got really sick, and I'll skip that for a little while. If you've never done it, don't. And so they sent me back to the island, and I ended up going to rehab. And they medevaced me from Adak to Philadelphia, and it took about 5 days to the best of my recollection. But I know we stopped at Elmendorf as my first stop, and they put me on that same ward, and that same doctor came in and gave me some Librium. And because I was sick and I was shaken and I was seeing things that weren't there and I was throwing up kind of violently on a regular basis because I was having withdrawals from alcohol, they gave me this Librium. And what I realized is every time I changed a plane or a hospital, I could ask and they'd give me two more. And we did a lot of hops on the medevac, and we'd stop here and we'd stop there, and every time I'd get on a new plane, I'd ask for more pills. And I got to Philly maybe 5 days later, and I was on a stretcher. I had broken my arm. I was in my pajamas. They wouldn't give me my uniform back anymore. And I don't know how that happened. I just know that, you know, I would ask, and they would give it to me. And the only thing I remember of landing there, I have postcards from across the country that, you know, Washington, D.C. I never knew I was in Washington, D.C., but I have a postcard. Anyway, I got to that rehab, and this little third-class medical corpsman came to the plane and met me, and I remember him cussing out the officer, like, she's here for rehab, and she's so effed up, she can't speak her name. And I thought it was kind of funny. I spent a little bit of time, and this came back to me years into recovery, too. I spent a week downstairs from the rehab in the regular part of the hospital and detoxing from the Librium they had me strung out on. And then I went up to this rehab, and there were 38 guys and me, and I was in heaven. I was 18 years old, and I was in my heyday. Oh, my God, this is what I always wanted. You know, who knew I would drink this way and get everything I ever wanted? And the only problem was we would go to these group sessions, and they'd go, you have a problem with alcohol? And I'd go, no, you guys don't understand. I do not have a problem with alcohol. I drink a little excessively, but I do it because I like it. I like to party. And they tell me, you can't drink anymore, and I was just baffled, because I could tell you from the time I picked up my very first drink of alcohol, it was the only thing that ever worked for me in my whole life. It settled my stomach better than Pepto-Bismol. It calmed my nerves better than the Librium. Alcohol did everything for me. You know, I took that first drink in my friend's living room in seventh grade, and You know, I intuitively knew supermodels were tall. Red hair was the new in thing to have. Everybody should go dye theirs. And my teeth shrunk, my boobs grew, and I just knew I had found the magic elixir to my life. And it was everything that I had ever wanted. And any time I was irritable, restless, and discontent, like it talks about in the big book, I could pick up a drink and it would work for a minute. And that's the trick, like it used to work for a long time. And then after a while, it would work for a little bit of time. And then after a minute, it would work for a minute. And then I was done. You know, I went through that rehab, and I don't know how long I stayed in there. It must have been about 3 weeks, and the first couple weeks are real hazy. I remember nothing. I remember going to a lot of A&A meetings. And I remember being in these group settings with all of these guys in the middle and having them yell nasty, horrible things at me, because that's what they did in rehab, I guess. I don't know. And nothing was sinking in, you know. I know that I would go into those A&A meetings at night, and I would meet nifty people, and sometimes I would hear stuff that I could relate to. But I don't know whether they were ever really, really clear, my counselor, when he sat me down and said, "You're an alcoholic, and here's how come." I thought, when I came to you guys, I must be an alcoholic because I've been to jail, I had a 502, I got kicked out of my mom's house, I beat up my mom, I robbed her house, I ripped you off, I did this, I got kicked out of the Navy, I threw up a lot. I came up with all of these reasons why I thought, okay, maybe I'm one of you when I was ready to come in here. And the truth of the matter is that none of those things have anything to do with why I'm an alcoholic. Tells me in the big book, in the doctor's opinion, that alcoholics have a mental obsession coupled with a physical allergy. And that physical allergy manifests itself in this thing called the phenomenon of craving. And I read that and I went, holy moly, that's why I drank. I would take a drink. There's an old proverb, they go, the Chinese or something, I don't know. The man takes a drink, the drink takes a drink, and off they go. And that's what happened to me. I would take a drink, and intuitively I knew I needed another one, and one was never enough. And I heard things like that after I came to you later. One's too many, and a thousand's never enough. But I didn't hear that when I was in Philly. So I was in that rehab, and they were teaching me stuff, and I thought, like, they wanted me to understand the physiological effect of alcohol on my system. And, you know, I thought maybe they wanted to look deeply into the relationship that I had with my mother. And I was looking for all of these things that I thought they wanted from me, and they didn't really want any of them. But I was clueless. And never once did the idea cross my brain that I had a real big problem with alcohol and I shouldn't drink it anymore. That one never went through there. So I was in a couple weeks, and they had started crushing my Anabuse tablets and mixing them with water and making me drink the liquefied Anabuse because I drank on Anabuse. And I'd stick them under my tongue and spit them out just in case, you know. Because I had some just in cases. In case that opportunity ever came up, I wanted to be able to take it without getting sick. And so they were liquefying this Anabuse, and I was in the rehab about 3 weeks, and we went to a Phillies game one Sunday. We went to this Phillies game, and my friend Mike and I decided we were going to try beer, right? The grand experiment beer on Anabuse. It's not like the first time I had done it. I thought maybe this time it was going to be a little different, that thinking, right? So we went, and he was like 6'97", and he weighed 350 pounds, and he got one of those big beers from Philly Stadium that they used to sell in the 80s, and he sucked down the full half, you know, because the top's bigger by volume, so I was having less, I thought. Because I always thought. So I drank the rest of it, and we rushed back to the seat because we were supposed to be in the bathroom, you know. And I was sitting there, and like a minute later, my face turned about the color of your shirt, and it was an unseasonably warm day in Philly in 1983. It got really hot, and I got a little sick to my stomach, and I spray puked 5 rows of Philly Stadium if I spray puked one. And I think it's funny today. I can promise you there was not anybody there that thought it was funny in 1983. It was not funny. The funny thing is, like 6 months ago, I tell that story all the time because I think it's a crack-up. About 6 months ago, I was up here, and you guys had this speaker, Bobby C., come in from Philly. Was anybody here that heard him speak? He was phenomenal, right? So he's talking about Philly Stadium and all of his heroes, and they're down on the field. And he says, and it was an unseasonably warm day in May, and my husband's going, oh, he's like shoving me in the ribs, because I always go like I spray puked 5 rows, and the only way that I know how to make amends for that is to say, if you were ever in Philly Stadium in 1983 and it was raining on you when it wasn't raining, you know, I'm really sorry. So Chris is poking me, and he's going, I swear to God, I'm going to make you stand up and make amends right in front of all the people in that room. And I was like, oh, shoot, right? Anyway, different story. Might have been the same game, but I don't remember. No, I would have remembered. He told his story. It wasn't the same game. So anyway, I went back to that rehab, and I was discharged. And they were sending me back over to the Naval Station for separation. I'd been in the military for about 1 year and 8 months. And I just went out of the room. So it was even at the end, but I was down in the morning about 8 o'clock. I was checking out of the hospital. And I was a guy named Jim Dean, and he said, if you ever want to get sober, call Alcoholics Anonymous, so you don't feel bad drunk. And I looked at him, and I couldn't breathe. There was something in me that just sucked all the air out. And I made the decision at that moment that I was going to go to the Naval Station. I was going to do whatever I had to do to save my career. I wasn't going to drink, no matter what. I had no problem not to do that. Firm resolution not to drink. And I was going to do whatever it took. I was going to go over to that neighborhood Alano Club in Philly, and I was going to ask that nasty wench out to be my sponsor. Is there any way we can remember people like that, like 24%? Just for a very split second, something in me broke. And you know, I hear lots of people
out and let's talk about different ways that they work the first three steps. Sometimes the first three steps are just instantaneous for me. You know, a lot of rehab tell us that we need to write the first steps, and we need to write about powerlessness and unmanageability, and we need to do whatever. And I didn't write about it. I had that moment in that car when I was touched by a power greater than me that I can believe in, or something else. And that was my first stop. Service, call central office and ask them what you could do. And this little man named Sam answered the phone and he saved my life. And I don't know why Sam knew I was a newcomer when I called. Jim told me, if you ever call, right, just tell him your name, tell him you're an alcoholic, because that's the one thing we're all in here is an alcoholic, so tell him that so they can relate and ask them for some help and they'll do anything to help you. And I was like, come on, right? So I go, okay, 411, my name's Tina and I'm an alcoholic. I put on my best I'm okay voice. I thought I was going to fool him one more time. I hadn't been fooling anybody in a long time, but I thought, you know, one more time. And Sam covered up the mouthpiece of the phone and he said to Eunice, the central office lady, we got a live one here, let's send her to Birch. And I swear to you, I don't know why I knew. I thought I was like, you know, I said what Jim told me to say. And my voice wasn't quivering too much. I thought I was going to pull it off. And they sent me over to this little Alano Club in Hawthorne called the Southwest Alano Club. And I stopped by the boys' market on the way. I stole a pad of paper and a pen because I thought I was going to be able to write down any pertinent information that you guys were going to give me that was going to enable me to get on about my merry way. So I stole this pad and this pen, and I walked into the Alano Club. And it was full. It was full. I was at 120 sucked up pounds. My husband likes to say I'm twice the man I was when I was new in Alcoholics Anonymous, because he's like 115, and he really is twice the man that he was when he came into Alcoholics Anonymous. I know. But I'm about 1 3/4 of the woman that I was when I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous. I weighed 120 pounds. I had just enough bile in my hair to pass as highlights. And I still could afford a hairdresser anyway, you know. And I had a big hole in the butt end of my jeans. And I loved it there because I would walk in and invariably people would go like this. And they wouldn't look in my face. Because once you looked in my eyeballs, you see there's just nobody home. And I didn't want anybody to look in my eyes. You know how we are when we come in, we can't meet your gaze because we know we're just the lowliest piece of garbage that ever walked the planet. And I'm not worthy for you to look at me. And that was the belief that I had when I came in here. I'm unworthy. I'm unlovable. I'm discardable. I am disposable. Because that had been the way that my life had looked forever. And so I came in here with that pad of paper and I sat down and I started writing the steps down on this tablet. And this lady came up and she scribbled across the page, having admitted to our innermost selves that we're real alcoholics, this is the first step in recovery. And, you know, most people would have been gratified that the woman was paying attention to them or that she cared enough to take a minute. I wanted to hit her. Because that's just how I was when I came in. I was angry and I was hugely fearful. I was full of the self-centered fear and I didn't even know what it was. And I liked to hit people. I was in the Navy. I liked to hit people. I was a sailor. But I walked into this meeting and she loved me. And I got a big book. This man named Olin that just passed away gave me my big book. And he had, God, I don't know, he's been sober since the 21st of May, 1961. He walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous in Roseburg, Oregon. If you're new in here, you guys will figure out a couple of those old-timers and those spiels that come time after time. And I used to sit there and I'd listen to Tom say that stuff and I'd go, God, shut up! And here I am, 21 years later, going, Tom Woods used to tell me. You know, that's what happens in here in Alcoholics Anonymous. We have this unique ability to relate one alcoholic with the other that I have never, ever found anywhere in my life. I can tell you, when I was new in here, they did that. They took that paper. They wrote on it. And I hung around that Alano Club for a long time. I used to hang out in the back room. They called it the Terminal Sobriety Room, the one that enabled me to not go get a job and look for work. And I would hang out back there, and I would shoot pool, and I would play cards with the old-timers, and I just hung out. And this old guy named Paul Matson came up to me, and I decided he was to be my sponsor because you guys told me men work with men, women work with women. So I picked Paul because that's how I was when I came in here. And he was this eclectic old guy. He was, I don't know, 60 or something. He's probably 40 and he just looked 60. Because everybody in the room, I swear to you, when I walked in, I was so scared and I looked around and they all looked like Bud. And I was like, oh, holy moly, I have died and gone to hell. And now I'm going to stay in here and not drink for the rest of my pathetic, miserable life until I die. And it's going to be just like that. And I love Bud. I love you, Bud. But I picked this guy named Paul Matson because he didn't talk a lot about God, and I didn't want to hear that stuff. And it's not so much that I didn't believe in God or I hated God or whatever. I had this unbelievable thing in my gut that told me that I was completely worthless. And if, in fact, there just might be a power greater than me, I was already done for. And so I just didn't want to bother. You know, it's that whole thing of don't love me because then you don't have to reject me. Doesn't matter how long I've been sober, I still play that. just stay over there and then it's not going to hurt when you leave. I played that with my husband at like, I don't know how many years we were together. I'm like, get the hell out! And he's going, no. That still baffles me. He goes, you said that and then I said no and you looked at me like, huh? like a confused puppy who just got their nose smacked with a paper. What? You know, but I did that all my life. I would get somebody close, and then I would know I was unworthy, and I would throw them away. What I would do is I would hurt you desperately, and then you would leave me, and I would get to be right about what I believed about myself. Now, let me tell you, that didn't take a lot of psychoanalysis and not thousands of dollars through a psychologist, just a 63-fourth steps. No, I'm just kidding. It's, you know, that's what the steps do, is they uncover all of that junk. But I came in, I asked that man to be my sponsor, and I came to believe that Paul Mattson could restore me to sanity, and I made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of Paul Mattson. And it worked. I worked for him. We went to a noon meeting. I worked for him. We went to a 5:30 meeting. We went to an 8:30 meeting. You know, I was with him all day. We went to three or four meetings a day. I got sober in the 6:45 meetings because I lived in that car behind the Alano Club for a little while. And, I, the secretary would come out and bang on the window and let me come in early so I could clean up a little bit because I stunk. And then I could eat all the cookies and donuts that I wanted and drink coffee before all you guys got there and made me look like a hog. So, but that's what I lived on, was the cookies and the coffee and you guys. And I can tell you that I worked some steps. I did an inventory and I shared it with Paul. I looked at all those character defects and I spent 2 years working on them, baby. I identified those defects of character and I was working on them. Wrong. Bad idea. I didn't figure this one out till 20 years sober, so sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. But I was doing the best I could, and I was listening to a lot of things. I was reading a lot of the literature. Some of those old-timers would take me into the meeting room, and they'd read me the book, and they'd explain it to me word for word for word, and they'd go through it. And I did those things, and I hung out with Paul, and I walked up to the Alano Club on the 10th day of October 1986. I had two long, hard, completely abstinent, sober years in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I went bouncing up to the club, and I was going to take my birthday cake, and I was so happy in that. And the coffee bar hostess came out, and she said, "Oh, honey," and I knew Paul died. And let me tell you, if your God has never died in Alcoholics Anonymous, that is a really scary thing. But what you guys did is you didn't leave me alone. And I was with you all the time. And I took that birthday cake and I convinced myself that Paul died on that day because he wanted to see me take my cake and he couldn't get out of the hospital. And it worked because it's all about me, you know. So anyways, I stuck around long enough to get another sponsor, and it was that wench that wrote on my paper that I wanted to hit. And she was the most spiritual woman I'd ever met in my life, and every other word out of her mouth was God. And mine too, God. And I went to this woman because I thought she had something to teach me, and we went through the steps some more. And she's been in my life my whole sober life. And she was diagnosed with breast cancer about a year ago, and she lives down in Southern California, and I snuck down there. I didn't tell her I was coming, and I was in the recovery room when she woke up, and she goes, like, "What are you doing here?" I go, "Where the heck else would I be?" You know, this is what we do for each other in here. I came in here, and I have a host of friends, and I came to Alcoholics Anonymous alone. I have a fantastic ability to look myself in the mirror today, and that didn't used to be the case, you know. I used to look myself in the rearview mirror because I was practicing my best pitch in Alcoholics Anonymous to go tell you, and then Paul would stand up and go, "You're finished now." And today, you know, somebody said to me, "Are you nervous?" And it's not so much about being nervous. I was fine. And then last week, Sam goes, "And our speaker next week will be Tina A. from Hollister." And I went, and I haven't been able to breathe for 7 whole days. In an hour. But the thing is like when I'm practicing and I'm trying to figure out what it is I'm going to say to you, I'm all locked up in me and I can't breathe and I'm anxious and I'm irritable, restless, and discontent, just like it talks about in the book. That's my favorite line. We're irritable, restless, and discontent unless we can again recapture the sense of ease and comfort which comes at once by taking a few drinks. That's the disease of alcoholism, and it doesn't matter how long I've been in here. I know that sense of ease and comfort that comes at once by taking a few drinks. But the second step tells me I also know what happens as a result of that. And the craziest thing I will ever do in my life is pick up a drink of alcohol knowing where it's going to take me. And that's the second and the third step. The fourth step tells me that I have to get down to the causes and the conditions. What are all those things that make me believe the way that I believe about me? And I have to share them with another person and with my God. The nifty thing that I didn't get about the sixth and seventh step, there's one little paragraph in the big book. They're so easy to just, like, skip over, you know? Like, blip, go home for an hour, read the paragraph, fine, I'm done. Let's do the eighth step. And so I ran around for years, and I was pissed off, and I was jealous, and I was all of these things that I came into Alcoholics Anonymous with. And a lot of them have gone away, but there's a couple of them that haven't. You know, and at like 17 and 18 years sober, I got these little kids, and they're like maniacal demons, you know. They're 14 and 18 years old now, and I would go to a meeting, and I'm coming home spiritual like, this was the greatest meeting I think we came here. This was the best meeting I've ever been to in my life. And I get a call, and they got a standoff in the kitchen with the butcher knives, and I'm like, son of a bitch, you know. Like, catching glimpses of myself in the mirror like, who is that crazy woman? And I'm just going to work on this anger, God, I'm going to hang on. I'm gonna, you know, and left to my own devices, let me promise you that I can do nothing. I get into that state and it just blows. It escalates by like nothing you've ever seen in your life. And I went on this little day-long retreat thing to Sedona, Arizona a couple days ago, and I wrote an inventory and I was looking at all these defects of character, not just that one, but that was at the top of the list. And I'm looking at these defects, and I'm looking at the defect of anger, and I'm seeing how it damages my children. And I'm looking at the defect of jealousy, and I'm seeing how it gets in the way of the relationship that I have with my husband. And I look at the defect of gossip and character assassination and judgment and all of these things that I am. And all of a sudden, I can't look in the mirror anymore. You know what I mean? That's not who I got sober to be. And if you're new in here, I want you to know more than anything, you can absolutely have anything, do anything, and be anything that you want in Alcoholics Anonymous if you don't pick up a drink a day at a time and you work the steps. The nifty thing is there's so much more. I'm running out of time. I was going, we need 17 birthdays in the long form of the traditions because I can't talk this long, but I'm not done. You know, the steps have set me free. They have absolutely saved my life and fixed everything about me that I thought was broken. And I can finally say at 21 years sober, I can look in the mirror and realize, like, I'm okay. You know, the neatest thing happened a couple years ago. I was thinking about that little boy, and I've been struggling with this relationship with God. I'm trying to define and comprehend it like the big book tells me I can't, because that's what I do. And I was thinking about this little boy that I have. He's 18. He wasn't then, but he's delayed entry in the Navy now. He's going to go be a SWIC member. He's going to be a member of the Special Boats Team in the Navy Special Forces, and he's leaving in September. And I'm thinking about this little boy that God gave me when I had a couple years sober. And I was like, I'd die for him. I would do anything for him. I would do anything to give him anything he would want. I love this kid till it hurts me. And I realize, like, I have a God that loves me just like that. And that's as deep as it has to go for me. I don't have to define and comprehend and figure out where he's at, what he's wearing, is it a boy, is it a girl, do I, you know, it doesn't matter for me. I have a relationship with a power greater than myself because you guys gave it to me. And I believe wholeheartedly in the God of my own understanding today because I see him work every single day in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. When one of us comes in here so broken that we can't look each other in the face anymore and we think we're discardable and unlovable. And if that's new, if that's you here, new tonight, I want you to know that you don't ever have to feel like that again for the rest of your life a day at a time either. Just do these simple things. The traditions bring us all together so that while we're working the steps and we're looking at our own stuff, we can come together and be one in here with you guys. And, you know, I love the second foreword in the big book that talks about the adolescent period of Alcoholics Anonymous, when we're ready to tear each other apart because we're getting into all this other stuff and we have no traditions. Those things right there unite us. And where else can a bunch of people who normally wouldn't mix come in here and save each other's lives? That's what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous. We give each other life back in here. And the greatest thing for me to know is I'm no better than, I'm no worse than, I'm no different than. It doesn't matter if I have a day or 21 years. I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's all I ever want to be. Thanks for letting me care.